ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you witnessed a wrongdoing, would you speak up about it? Or would you hesitate, worried about the consequences of telling someone? Whistleblowers, they've been responsible for exposing egregious cases of corruption and misconduct, often at great personal cost. Some whose names you may know. Tax office whistleblower Richard Boyle, robo-debt whistleblower Colleen Taylor, banking whistleblower Jeff Morris, and then there was the Manus Island whistleblower Liz Thompson. Others are names you may never know. And today on Big Ideas, what does it take to blow the whistle? And why is Australia failing to protect those who do? Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Welcome to Big Ideas.
Percent of Australians want better whistleblowing laws, think whistleblowers make Australia a better place. Whether you vote for the Greens, Teals, Libs, Labor or One Nation, you like whistleblowers, but that hasn't translated yet to reform. Now, I'm an optimist. I think that reform will come, but we've been waiting for too long. And while we wait, things continue to go wrong in the darkness. You know, that famous saying that democracy dies in the darkness. What wrongdoing is going on right now that we don't know about because people can't speak up?
And later in the show, you'll hear a powerful first-hand testimony from an anonymous whistleblower about their experiences of working in youth detention. First, the big thinkers today are Kieran Pender, who is Associate Legal Director of the Human Rights Law Centre, where he established the Whistleblower Project, Australia's first dedicated service, providing legal advice and representation for those who wish to speak up against wrongdoing. Gabrielle Shipton, a filmmaker and founder of the Information Rights Project, that's a charity established to support and protect whistleblowers. He's also the brother of perhaps the world's most famous whistleblower, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, spearheading the long campaign for his freedom. Let's join them at the University of New South Wales's Centre for Ideas on Bidjigal and Bedigal Country, with host, former editor of Guardian Australia, Lenore Taylor.
So, we are here tonight, obviously, to talk about whistleblowing, why it's so important, why it's important that people can safely say something when they see something that is quite evidently wrong, fraud, corruption, illegality, misconduct, so that they can say someone something no matter what position of power they themselves hold in the organisation where they see the wrongdoing happening. Why it's important for people to be able to tell the truth about what they see, not just for them and their organisation, but for all of us. We want to talk about what whistleblowing can achieve, but also to have a realistic conversation about not only the difference it can make, but the difficulties in doing it, about how it is possible to stand up and talk about things that you see wrong and call things out. And also about the sort of the attitude that everyone should bring or would ideally bring to whistleblowing and to the idea of speaking up and how we view people who do talk about things when they see things that are wrong. So let's start with what whistleblowers have achieved, the difference they've made. I mean, as a journalist and an editor, I know that many, many really big and impactful stories, many of them, start with a whistleblower who wanted to reveal some information. Sometimes we know their names. Oftentimes we don't. So I'd like to just talk about some of those cases so we set the scene about what whistleblowing can do. Kieran, do you want to start with some examples of the biggest whistleblowing cases that you've been involved with or that you've seen and what they've done?
Sure. Thanks, Lenore, and thanks everyone for coming along tonight. I think your point is really important that there are so many people who've blown the whistle, many of whom have done that at great personal costs, and we only know the tip of the iceberg cases. But the two cases that I often reflect on Firstly, some of the whistleblowers whose very courageous whistleblowing led to the Banking Royal Commission. I think it's a really tangible example because everyone in the audience tonight is better off because brave people spoke up about wrongdoing in the financial sector. The banking sector affects every person in this country. We had a Banking Royal Commission. We had change as a result. But some of those people, the Jeff Morrises of the world, the Dr. Ben Coes of the world, sacrificed a lot to expose that wrongdoing, to get that change, which has benefited all of us. Another example that we're involved in at the Human Rights Law Centre is that of those who blew the whistle on Robodebt. The Guardian did a lot of important reporting under your tenure, Lenore, on Robodebt that wouldn't have been possible without brave people speaking up. We're very proud to act for Jeannie Marie Blake, who was one of the original Robodebt whistleblowers who gave evidence to the Royal Commission. And I often reflect on her whistleblowing and others and what might have been different if they'd been listened to. So from the very beginning of Robodebt, people said, this is wrong, this is unlawful, this is unethical. We're talking literally over $1 billion that could have been saved, untold human suffering, and tragically actual human lives that could have been saved if people like Jenny were listened to from the start.
Yeah, and both she and Colleen Taylor wrote to the head of the department and said, this is wrong, we should not be stealing from our own clients, and were completely ignored. Gabrielle, you are also helping whistleblowers and and supporting them in many ways. Can you talk to us about somebody you've been dealing with who's really made a difference?
Yeah, so one of our most recent live cases that we're working on at Information Rights Project at the moment is an ex-ASIO spy, codenamed Marcus. Marcus worked undercover as an ASIO spy for 6 years. In radical Islamic groups in Western Sydney, and he did a Four Corners episode where he blew the whistle on what he saw there and what he'd reported to ASIO in regard to the two Bondi shooters that he'd identified. One of the shooters back in 2019 and reported that to his superiors. Now, I think we're still seeing the impact of what his whistleblowing will do, but Marcus is already, I guess, suffering from his...
He's living overseas.
That's right. He's living on the run. We've raised around $50,000 to cover his safe houses and living expenses while he's overseas because he's facing death threats from the ISIS-linked groups that he infiltrated. And I think in Marcus's case, the Bondi massacre or the Bondi shooting was an atrocious thing, a sort of blight on our culture and society, right? It's one of these things that I think everybody in Australia just turns your stomach. And having someone like Marcus come forward and blow the whistle on our institutions that they could have done better, that they could have potentially stopped this, is very important, and very important that he's heard at the highest level. So his case still has a bit of space to run, and hopefully there are some changes within ASIO because of what he's revealed.
National security is a particularly tricky area, though, isn't it? Because by definition, national security is about secrecy, but by the same token, there has to be some mechanism to call out wrongdoing, particularly in an area that is by definition secret. And some of the trickiest cases over the years, like the Bernard Collaery and Witness K and Marcus, and, you know, even your brother was charged under the Espionage Act, right? Like, talk to me a bit about how you... Can you take national security cases at the Whistleblowing Project?
Only in very limited circumstances. So the law is very limited in the extent we can assist people blow the whistle on national security matters. That's a problem because it means that people can't get the legal assistance they need. I think too often, though, we have this false dichotomy that transparency and national security are in tension. Yeah. And I'd say in most cases, the opposite. So certainly I'm not a transparency absolutist. I accept that ASIO needs some degree of secrecy to operate effectively. But in Australia, the balance is entirely tilted in the other direction. We have at the moment over 850 secrecy laws on the federal statute book, over 850 ways in which people can be prosecuted for speaking up. To their credit, the Labor government, which in some respects hasn't acted on whistleblowing and other things we might talk about later, the government is in the process of repealing some of those laws. You know, yes, national security whistleblowing, you know, maybe is not the archetype, and a lot of the important whistleblowing we see is in other areas, but in some ways it's the canary in the coal mine, yeah, because it's the most acute example of that clash between state power, wrongdoing, and really courageous people speaking up.
Yeah. Did you want to quickly talk to that before we go to the first part of our video?
Yeah, I think those particular cases, the national security cases, they're the ones arguably where the whistleblowers take the biggest risk. Because the power that they're going up,
the penalties are, yeah,
the power that they're going up against is, you know, all powerful, right? Like they can, you know, ASIO has these incredible powers, you know, just to take you in, question you, not release you. The secrecy laws, like we saw in Bernard Collaery's case, where the whistleblower, we still don't know who it is. They can't leave the country. Like all these, and even if talking to them, and if you're a journalist, you talk to them, it's a crime. And so that is really, I think, that edge of whistleblowing that we try to work in, that we try to support those whistleblowers, because that is where the most power in the state exists, and so it needs, we argue, more scrutiny than other areas.
We're now going to hear the first part of this testimony from a whistleblower who's agreed to share their experience with you all here tonight. Their voice has been altered and their appearance is obscured to protect their anonymity. I think they have asked us to tell you that choosing not to reveal their identity is not in any way taking away from their commitment to come forward, to tell their story and to try to make a difference. And what they have to say and their experience really does go to the heart of the discussion about what it means to speak up. So let's just hear from the first part of their testimony.
I was working in a children's prison when I witnessed several events which made me extremely concerned for the welfare of young people. In this prison, young people faced extended periods of isolation. There were not enough staff to be able to facilitate the children leaving their rooms. They were kept like animals in spaces the size of a car park for 23 and a half hours a day. This quickly became a normalized part of working in the prison. Then one day, a young person managed to set light to his mattress while he was locked in his room. The fire alarms went off and everyone had to evacuate. But it was determined by more senior-ranking staff that there were not enough staff members to safely remove the boy from his room. The rigid internal hierarchies meant that the humane decision to remove the boy could not be made by the staff member. It's lucky he didn't die. But these things don't need to be left to luck. Our obsession with protecting ourselves meant that the imminent danger to the young person was less important than the possible risk to the staff member. We have a colossal issue with Indigenous deaths in custody in this country. These issues are caught up in dehumanising hierarchies and rigid pathways of authority. That staff member was technically a guardian to that boy. He had a responsibility to protect him. I first realised things were not right when my male colleague broke down and cried in the office. It is not usual in this country for a grown man to cry at work, especially not a man who works in a prison. On this day, my colleague had witnessed children on the cameras pacing back and forth, bashing on the doors, screaming, desperate. Things were very tense. When we were able to have contact with the young people, they spoke from a place of experiencing intense terror. Some became suicidal. We consoled ourselves with phrases like, "You have to be tough to work in here," and "That's just how things are." It was continuously confusing and hurtful to us that leadership failed to listen when we approached them as calm and concerned humans witnessing inhumane activities. It is challenging to say that you believe something is wrong when people around you condone and even endorse the behaviour. I knew we had to do something, and we started by using the organisation's internal channels with no positive result. After having exhausted internal channels, a group of employees collectively wrote an account of the wrongdoing we had witnessed and sought legal advice. In our case, we were protected because we acted as a group. Being part of a group gave us courage, and it protected our sanity and our humanity. The legal advice we received made us aware that, despite the protections that come with raising concerns through Parliament, there were grave practical risks to us and our employment. For some of us, the risk extended to visa statuses, and the capacity to continue to live and work in this country. The threat of these reprisals was enough to silence us. The members of our group have families, they have dependents, they have mortgages. The power of the government to destroy livelihoods, to resort to unjust sanctions because they can and we cannot, well, that's violence right there. Those are the bars of our cage, as cold and hard as any steel.
So that really does highlight how hard whistleblowing can be and the toll that it can take. Kieran, can you tell us about the kind of assistance that your organisation can offer, the kind of demand that there is for your services, and how it works out for whistleblowers in sort of the best and worst case scenarios?
Sure. So I'm permitted to say that that individual in the video is a client of ours, very proud to have assisted that person. We launched the Whistleblower Project at the Human Rights Law Centre 3 years ago because we recognised how hard it was for people to speak up. In Australia, we have all of these laws that say if you speak up, you're protected. They weren't working. They still are not working in many cases. But we launched our service to say, well, these people need specialist assistance because of the public interest in what they're doing. We've been overwhelmed by the demand since we launched. We've been contacted by over 700 individuals, triaged their cases. We've advised over 220, 230 whistleblowers, represented over 60, been involved in a bunch of different litigation. I think one of the challenges is that every experience is unique, and there are some really positive experiences where the wrongdoing is addressed and the whistleblower is never known. We've had some great outcomes, you know, front pages, investigations, inquiries, change, really substantial change that have come about because our clients have spoken up, often working together with journalists at The Guardian and other publications. In the worst case scenario, we know people lose their jobs, lose their livelihoods, and, you know, we're not directly involved, but we were peripherally involved and did a lot of advocacy in cases like Richard Boyle, the tax office whistleblower, David McBride, who leaked documents about war crimes in Afghanistan to the ABC. You know, people can lose their liberty, and David McBride's still in jail right now in Canberra. Even in the best case scenario, I don't think any of my clients don't have a difficult time, but if you ask most of my clients, would they do it again? They say yes, because they know that they've done the right thing and they can look in the mirror and feel that they've made a positive difference to society. And I think part of, you know, we do a lot of work to then change the law, improve the structures, because it shouldn't be that hard to speak truth. The cost of courage is too hard at the moment, and that's what we need to fix to have a better society.
High stakes when we choose to stand up for right over wrong. And Kieran Pender runs a specialist legal service for whistleblowers at the Human Rights Law Centre. Natasha Mitchell bringing you ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today at the Centre for Ideas at the University of New South Wales. Also with filmmaker Gabrielle Shipton, who founded another whistleblower organisation called the Information Rights Project, which was born from his work campaigning to free his famous whistleblowing brother, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And the event host today is former editor of Guardian Australia, Lenore Taylor.
Do you see any change in the way that, say, corporations, their attitude towards whistleblowers, like the KPMG case that's in the news at the moment? I mean, that to me looks like the case, the sort of 101 of how a corporation shouldn't deal with a whistleblower.
Exactly. I think those high-profile cases have a salient effect, and probably the next whistleblower in a large corporation will be treated slightly differently. But unfortunately, until we get the, you know, at heart, we have a power imbalance. We have powerful institutions, government agencies, corporations, and individuals exposing inconvenient truths.
Who look like troublemakers.
And until we fundamentally shift that power imbalance and use the structures of the law and the laws that on paper look okay but aren't working in practice, until we fix that, it's still going to be too hard to speak up.
Mm-hmm. And Gabrielle, your organisation also offers support, as you're saying, to people like Marcus. How does your capacity meet demand, and what's your reflection on the testimony that we just heard about how difficult this can be?
Yeah, congratulations to Kieran. I mean, without his organisation, I think we should just give him a round of applause.
Yes.
For all the work they do. Yeah, that, you know, it's left to a handful of organisations to do this work in Australia, and we're all funded by donations, by people, by individuals out there like you all here. And it's amazing to see.
It's incredible.
Yeah,
it's
this
fantastic.
Turnout tonight. It's very, heartwarming to see that you all coming out and care about this. But just to sort of bounce off a bit what Kieran said is like changing this idea about whistleblowers, like that they're troublemakers, you know, that and switching that to, you know, it is all our civic duty to do this. If we see something wrong, it's our civic duty to speak out, and sort of beginning to reframe that culturally, I think is a really important part of the work that we both do. I mean, we can do it here on platforms like this, but it also has to happen, you know, in films and books and other things like that. The work that we do at Information Rights, I think, sort of stemmed from our fight to free Julian Assange. We found, particularly in Julian's case, where he was butting up against this extreme state power, you know, that's sort of uninhibited, that there were a lot of organisations who just, you know, a lot of closed doors, organisations that would have normally come to the aid of somebody like Julian, they weren't there at the very beginning. Eventually they did all come around, but at the beginning they weren't there. And so what we did during that campaign is we sort of built the bike as we were riding it, in a sense, and we built up this infrastructure, this campaigning infrastructure, this network of people who care about truth, about their right to know. And now we've moved that into the Information Rights Project and using that same machinery, that same network, to help other people who have blown the whistle. And we can help them in very sort of practical ways because we have that practical experience, right? Like, I know as a family, like the hardship that we went through, you know, just trying to raise money to try and, you know, find housing, you know, pay for food, like campaigning as a family member as well, like quitting your job, like you put you risk everything.
Yeah.
And so we have an understanding of that. And so we built this organisation to be able to support precisely on that level. And that's what we've been doing, you know, basically raising money and, you know, paying for safe houses, paying for living expenses, so that these whistleblowers not only know that they have, you know, an incredible mind like Kieran and his team behind them to defend them legally, but there is someone else who will support them as well through when they do lose their jobs. And so hopefully our idea is like, well, if these whistleblowers know, or these truth tellers know, that there is someone out there, that there will be more of them.
Yeah. And obviously this is also linked to a question for press freedom, right? Like, one place is whistleblowers can go at it as a last resort is the media. They're often punished for it, like Richard Boyle or David McBride were. But, you know, you can see Australia dropping down the World Press Freedom Index. You can see that even when they do everything right, it can go badly for them. I know, you know, Julian said he was found guilty of committing journalism, you know, because he had to plead guilty under the Espionage Act. It's a connected question, press freedom and whistleblowing, yeah?
100%. And it would be, I think, a lot of media outlets have recognised that and have done some good work in this area, but I think we need more campaigning from press organisations, because whistleblower protections are a press freedom issue.
Yes.
If you don't have sources, you don't have journalism, and if we don't have protections for people to speak up, and as you say, that's the last resort, but it's also an avenue that the law recognises. So
yes.
Almost all Australian whistleblowing laws say, speak up internally, speak up to the regulator. If it doesn't work, you are legally permitted to go to a journalist, to an MP. Unfortunately, it's just
media.
Been too hard. You know, Richard Boyle, a great case, blew the whistle the right way, thought he was doing the right thing, ends up on Four Corners. You know, you have investigations that vindicate him.
He made a couple of mistakes.
But the court says, actually, we're not going to, the prosecution wasn't for his whistleblowing, it was for the evidence he gathered to blow the whistle internally. That he could never have known that wasn't going to be protected, and that wasn't evidence he gathered to give to the journalist. It was just to blow the whistle internally.
Yeah, and it took him years.
Yeah, and he was prosecuted, and that dragged on for 7 or 8 years. And you know, the reason we've done so much work on those cases and also acknowledge the good work of Gabriel and his team is the chilling effect that sends. You know, I think what's really hard and something that I reflect on a lot is we have great outcomes that no one ever knows about, where the whistleblower speaks up, the wrongdoing's addressed, they move on with their life. But the cases that are in the media are where things go wrong. And so part of it's that cultural change piece that Gabriel mentioned. How do we get everyone in the audience to know that if you go to work tomorrow and you see something wrong, come to us, get good legal advice, and there can be good outcomes and your life doesn't have to suffer. Like, it's never going to be a pleasant journey, but it doesn't have to be an incredibly hard journey if we do it right. And that's what I... Because it's really hard in our work. We don't want to discourage people from blowing the whistle because that would be bad for the public interest. But people do need to go into it eyes wide open.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to hear the second part of the video with the whistleblower talking about the system and what kind of change is needed for people like them to speak up.
The outcome from our group's efforts to speak out was silenced. The power of the government to threaten our employment and our livelihoods meant that we couldn't take the case to court or to parliament. The case did get some exposure in the media, but it wasn't the significant impact we envisioned. Overall, we couldn't change the situation for these children. However, there are many more strong individuals who have been able to speak out in important ways, including David McBride, Richard Boyle, Liz Thompson, Colleen Taylor, and Jeannie Marie Blake. They are our heroes, but we have failed to recognise them. For some reason, we prefer to be blind to the actions of the authorities that claim to defend us. We would rather not know about the violent acts done in our name. Is this true? Is this who we are? In each of these circumstances, there were hundreds of individuals in these workplaces who were happy enough to just keep working. They turned away, they took home the wage, they kept their heads down. These people are not free. Our freedom is deeply bound up in each other. Have you witnessed unethical practices? Have you seen something you believe to be wrong? If you raise the problem following the correct internal channels laid out for you to follow, what happens? What do you experience? You will soon feel the bars of your cage, and it is your cage. It is your voice, your reason, your knowledge which is being repressed, your humanity. This voice you have is the capacity to shape something new, to imagine a different future, a more just future.
So that whistleblower didn't achieve what they set out to do, but they still obviously believe fervently and with all their heart in the process of what they were trying to do, which is a difficult thing to hear. Kieran, I know there are legal changes that are being discussed right now, a review of the current laws. Can you just kind of talk us through what should what is being proposed and what you think should be proposed?
Sure. We need better laws and we need better support for people who blow the whistle. So about 30 years ago, the first ever federal parliamentary inquiry into whistleblowing laws said we need whistleblowing laws and we need a whistleblowing institution to oversee and enforce those laws and to support whistleblowers. Eventually, we got the laws. We're still waiting on that institution. We've been calling for a long time now for a whistleblower protection authority. Not a novel idea, been called for many times here. We have whistleblower protection authorities overseas in a range of different countries. Right now, there's a review of our private sector laws undertaken by the Department of Treasury. It's open for consultation right now. I'd encourage everyone here to get on their website and have a look at that and make a submission. We've got proposed reform to public sector whistleblowing laws. So the Albanese government is moving forward. We don't think it's moving fast enough or boldly enough.
Or quickly enough.
Certainly not quickly enough. These were commitments made before their first election in 2022 that we're still waiting on. And you know, I guess the KPMG example is a good one. There's a gap where people who work for partnerships...
Should we just talk a bit about what happened there? Because I'm not maybe...
Yeah, certainly. So someone tried to blow the whistle on wrongdoing at KPMG, you know, big consulting, accounting, auditing firm... ultimately have to escalate it to a senator who raises it in parliament. Now there's been all of this accountability. One of the reasons that person had to go to a senator was because partnerships are not covered by Australian whistleblowing law. So that's just a big gap right there. But then it's also
which
the question
which covers
of,
most law firms, accounting firms. Like that's a lot
so
of...
a big part of our economy, a big part of the power in our society that's totally omitted from our whistleblowing laws. But then there's that question of support. Where can people go for support? You know, our work is philanthropically funded and we currently have a partnership with the New South Wales Ombudsman where we assist people referred from them. we can't help everyone. Where are the structures and support processes? Where's the Whistleblower Protection Authority? You know, I like to say, if you are discriminated against at work, you can go to the Human Rights Commission. If you're underpaid at work, you can go to the Fair Work Ombudsman. Given the public interest in whistleblowing, why don't we have a Whistleblower Protection
Authority?
There
was a private members bill, right, and it got... Can you tell us what happened to that? I mean, it just got nixed, didn't it?
Yeah, Andrew Wilkie, Helen Haynes, David Pocock and Jackie Lambie put forward a proposal for that bill and the government didn't take it forward. That's really disappointing because this Labor government, after the Banking Royal Commission, when they were in opposition, said, we're going to set up a Whistleblower Protection Authority. Obviously, everyone remembers that election was lost and all of those ideas were forgotten. But it was a good idea then. It's an even better idea now. Rex Patrick, the former senator, likes to say that you only like transparency when you're in opposition. But it's worked in other countries. The US, you know, it's funny, there's so much commentary about the decline of democracy in the United States. And obviously, there are big problems in the US right now. But they're light years ahead of Australia when it comes to protecting whistleblowers. Yeah. So, you know, we shouldn't throw stones.
And there's quite a cross-party, there's a lot of support for whistleblowing in unexpected places in our parliament too, right?
Yeah. One of the really heartening things is we've done a lot of polling over the years that shows the breadth and depth of support for whistleblowing in Australia. 80-90% of Australians want better whistleblowing laws, think whistleblowers make Australia a better place. Whether you vote for the Greens, Teals, Libs, Labor or One Nation, you like whistleblowers, but that hasn't translated yet to reform. Now, I'm an optimist. I think that reform will come, but we've been waiting for too long. And while we wait, things continue to go wrong in the darkness. You know, that famous saying that democracy dies in the darkness. What wrongdoing is going on right now that we don't know about because people can't speak up? You know, the KPMG example is such a great one. If it wasn't for Senator Deborah O'Neill standing up on a Thursday night at 9 p.m. in the Senate and saying KPMG are doing these bad things, we'd never know about that. That's not a system that's working well.
Do you have any thoughts about the systemic change, the legal change that we need to have?
Yeah, well, look, I think you made a reference to the United States. I think that they've got, we don't have freedom of speech or enshrined in our constitution. They have the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech enshrined in their constitution. That protects journalists as well as whistleblowers. So I think having something very strong in the constitution, I think would help us. We don't have to, it doesn't have to be, you know, US centric, but it can be an Australianized version, something that suits us here in Australia. But not just protecting whistleblowers, but protecting whistleblowers, journalists, that whole line of information of how the public gets informed about what our governments are doing, what our corporations are doing, but more importantly, what our governments are doing in our name. I think it's important to for any democracy to have that whole line. But, you mentioned the bipartisan support, and you know, we saw some odd bedfellows in our time. We'd go to have meetings in Parliament and we'd have people like...
With the Free Julian campaign.
Yeah, with the Free Julian, Friends of Julian Assange parliamentary group, and we'd have, you know, Adam Bandt, the ex-Greens leader, sitting next to Malcolm Roberts from One Nation and, you know, both of them, you know, supporting Julian Assange. And just last month, or not 2 months ago, it was 2 months ago, right? We spoke at the... Yeah, so Kieran and I spoke at this Friends of Whistleblowers group in Parliament, which is... again, a bipartisan, multi-partisan group, actually, with, you know, co-chaired Labor, Liberal and two independents. And so it's very odd walking into those rooms and seeing, you know, people like Barnaby Joyce and Monique Ryan
getting
together.
It's good that they
together.
Can agree on something.
I know, it's incredible. It becomes a story in itself, right? And yeah, I think that has some power and some momentum into it, but it's just about, you know, can we forget about our partisan politics and focus on these democratic principles and really drive something home that helps everybody?
Unpredictable allies in the name of whistleblowing. Our topic today on Big Ideas across Australia on ABC Radio National, everywhere, anytime, streaming via the ABC Listen app and as podcast. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and if you're listening live, you can text us. Your response as you're listening, the ABC Radio National SMS line 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. Or email the show whenever you like, bigideas@abc.net.au. The big thinkers today are Associate Legal Director of the Human Rights Law Centre, Kieran Pender, filmmaker and founder of the Information Rights Project, Gabrielle Shipton, and host, former editor of Guardian Australia, Lenore Taylor. So are some people or groups more likely to blow the whistle?
I was reading something you wrote, Kieran, and it really struck me because we've been talking about a lot of examples from banking and finance, and but I read that you said a lot of the cases that you're taking at the moment are from care professions, which I think kind of sent a chill through me because of the kinds of things that a whistleblower in aged care or childcare might be blowing the whistle on.
Yeah, so we did a really great piece of work and acknowledge my amazing team, a few of whom are here tonight. Last year, we published a report called Women Speaking Up about the gendered dynamics of whistleblowing. You know, the high-profile whistleblowers in Australia recently have been the David McBrides and Richard Boyles. But in our client data, we were seeing that a majority of our clients were women, and a lot of them were raising concerns about wrongdoing in the NDIS, in aged care, in nursing, in hospitals. And in those sectors, we have some really weak laws. So the NDIS sector has the worst whistleblower protection laws under any federal law. We just managed to get some reform to that a couple of months ago. That was a significant step forward. More work to be done. But as you say, the wrongdoing that's going on in those places where there's no accountability, there's such power imbalances, that is so critical we get right. And yet, unfortunately, for too long, that wrongdoing has been allowed to go on unchecked.
Yeah. And I guess the last thing I wanted to raise with both of you, which we've sort of touched on through this discussion, is about not just the legal change, but the attitudinal change. Like, how do we get to a point where whistleblowers are seen as heroes, are seen as people doing the right thing? Like, what are your thoughts about how that shift in attitude can happen?
Yeah, you need the media to be on side. I think we sort of touched on it already, right? We need media, artists. It has to be a whole cultural movement. These sort of things are great. These sort of events are really wonderful. Getting people together, talking about it amongst yourselves. I'm sure you will after you leave here tonight. Hopefully you're telling people tomorrow what a great whistleblower event that you went to, and maybe inspiring someone, you know, who has seen something to come forward and speak to Kieran. But yeah, it's not going to happen easily, but it's going to take a lot of effort, and it's going to take a whole community to do that. And that's what we are sort of doing at Information Rights, is we're coalescing that community, keeping them informed of what's going on, and, you know, having these cultural events. And I guess I can sort of think back to Julian's case, how we sort of moved the dial for his case, and it didn't happen overnight. And took 5 years to get Julian Assange out of prison. And we had to change the way people thought about Julian. And we had to do hundreds of events like these. There were three or four films made. There were books made. Artists were writing songs. People like Ai Weiwei were doing art pieces. Like, it takes that sort of movement and momentum to really change our cultural perspective.
The laws are one thing, but I think one of the things that most of our clients find so hard is how isolating the journey is blowing the whistle. There's so much secrecy or confidentiality wrapped up in the process. It's very hard for people to talk about it. And so I think something that everyone can do is, in your own workplaces, support people who are speaking up, are raising concerns, maybe are being ostracised as troublemakers, but are trying to do the right thing, trying to raise concerns that are in the public interest. Everyone can play that part. And then that bigger piece, the law reform, it's letting the government know that this matters to you, writing to your local MP, your local senator, speaking to them and saying, whistleblowing matters, the government needs to do more. The Albanese government talks a good game on transparency. In some areas they've delivered, in some areas they haven't. We need to push them to go further.
Great. We are getting some fantastic questions through on Slido, so I'm going to go to some of them. I'm going to group these two together. One is, what advice would you give someone who's witnessed serious wrongdoing but is terrified that using the formal reporting challenges will just expose them? And then there was another one that was, with the availability and ease of digital investigation, what advice can you give to whistleblowers about how not to be discovered?
Yeah, I'll go first on those. I mean, get legal advice first. But most whistleblowing laws allow you to blow the whistle anonymously. And so something we say to a lot of people, if they're concerned Of course, if they work in a five-person organisation, that may be difficult. But if you're in a large organisation, you can blow the whistle anonymously and then you can see how it's dealt with, and it may be that you gain confidence that they are taking it seriously and you're willing to come forward. But you can start with those small steps. Information security is a big concern. We've published a number of guides on our website that deal with digital footprints. That is a big concern, that people can be tracked, the whistleblowing can be monitored. And so that's something that we encourage people to take seriously. Certainly don't go emailing confidential documents to your personal Gmail. Don't do that. That's not legal advice.
And do you do, this is sort of asking for a friend, but do you do education for journalists as well? I mean, I know my best investigative reporters knew exactly what to do and how to, but if someone picks a high profile journalist, would they necessarily know what to do and not do?
A lot of our best referrals come from investigative journalists. Yeah. Whistleblower goes to the journalist. Journalist says, get legal advice, yeah. Speak to Kieran's team.
Yeah.
No, finding a sympathetic journalist, I think, is probably, you know, one way to go. Or someone, you know, obviously do your research on them and make sure they haven't burnt off their sources in the past, I think, is probably a good example of someone who treats sources with care. Yeah, and practice that digital hygiene. There's lots of guides online. Kieran's website has some, but also, you know, Freedom of the Press Foundation. They have, you know, really strong guides of how to use different operating systems and things like that, if that's what you're really worried about.
I have another question. If you could each secure one reform in the next 12 months, what would it be and why that one first? These are good questions.
It's been our number one campaign platform for a long time, a whistleblower protection authority that covers the public and private sector in Australia. It's a no-brainer. They work elsewhere in the US, in the Netherlands, in Slovakia. I recently discovered there's a whistleblower protection authority in the Maldives. I've been angling for a study trip to the Maldives to go and have a look at that. So if I can get the study trip first and then we can get one in 12 months in Australia,
that would be the right way around. Yeah, yeah. And why, I mean, what did the major party, the government, say when that private members bill was put up? Like, why did it get such short shrift?
The government has said it's not convinced it's necessary and is unfortunately proceeding in quite a segmented way, public sector reform, private sector reform, separate. We say it's all related. You've got a lot of contractors that are private sector but working for government. Unfortunately, the government hasn't yet seen the light, but as I said, I'm an optimist. We'll get there.
And did you have a top of the pops reform?
Oh, yeah, we'd get David McBride out of jail.
He's... We should talk about that, right, because his parole, he's got a parole hearing coming up, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. His parole is coming up, potential parole hearing coming up in August. He got around a five-year sentence, so I think it would be 2 years into his sentence. He's now up for parole. And so we're really pushing for that, to get David McBride out of prison and stop treating whistleblowers like they're criminals. You know, David should be treated like a hero from my perspective, even though he's convicted of a crime in this country. He is not a criminal at all. And I think getting him out of jail would be, yeah, it'd be nice to have him back to his family. And if we could do that for him, that would be amazing.
This is an interesting question. The question is, what organisational conditions make whistleblowing the last resort rather than internal reporting, which is interesting, right? Like, what is a best practice company, organisation, faculty with internal processes that might mean you never actually have to blow the whistle? Is there templates for that? Like, who does it well?
You can have all the policies and processes, and that's obviously important, but I think it comes down to culture. And is the organisational culture one that values people speaking up? There are lots of organisations where that happens. So sometimes we help people speak up internally, they're listened to, it's dealt with, it's addressed. We also find that a lot of times people come to us only after they realise that they are a whistleblower. So people speak up because they think it's their job. They think they're just doing what they should. And it's only when things go wrong that they approach us. But, you know, I don't want this to be all doom and gloom. There's lots of organisations that do have all of the right processes. And I think the change, the reform, some of these high profile examples are good in terms of pushing that further. But ultimately, what makes organisations and agencies act? It's regulation and the law and oversight and enforcement. You know, the private sector regulator in Australia has brought one enforcement action in the 6 years since the law was changed. They secured a $7 million penalty for a company that mistreated a whistleblower. We need more of that. You know, we could fund the Whistleblower Protection Authority just by enforcement action. You know, I often use the example of Robodebt. If Robodebt had been stopped at the start, we'd pay for a whistleblowing authority for 100
10
years.
10 times over, 100 times over. Yeah, exactly. This kind of goes to what you were, this question goes to what you were mentioning before, but I think it's interesting to think about. What role can storytelling, whether through film, media or campaigns, play in building public empathy for whistleblowers before they're dismissed or demonised?
Yeah, well, I'm a filmmaker. That's by trade. Mm. So, I've seen, you know, storytelling change people's minds in many cases, and we're using it all the time to convince people to come around to our side. And it's really these individual human stories that I think really change people's minds. And putting ourselves in their shoes, in that person's shoes, and asking ourselves, would we do the same thing, given what this person is going through? I think that we've found that really moves people. And so storytelling, it works on many levels. You know, if you're in a congressional office talking to a lawmaker, we're still doing that storytelling, doing that work in those settings, but also in a grander sense with, you know, filmmaking or writing books. But yeah, it is. I'm biased, and I just think, like, this is, you know, we're all humans and we all connect with each other through these personal stories and these emotions. And I think once you open somebody's heart, then you open their mind to these changes.
There were those really good, there was the television series on Robodebt, or two, I think, that pulled it all together in a story. And even though, you know, we in the Saturday paper had written a lot of those stories along the way, and I'd read the Royal Commission report, it still kind of had such an impact on me to see it all brought together in a narrative.
And I think the personal dimension to it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of our discussion tonight has been underpinned by sort of democratic values, transparency, secrecy, accountability.
People.
But at the heart of it, these are people whose lives are affected by corporate wrongdoing or government wrongdoing. And then so much of the whistleblowing journey is so personal as well. Certainly, I think what's led to some of the successful campaigns, you know, I think about Richard Boyle. There was a very moving 7:30 story with Adele Ferguson talking about him and his wife and the impact that it had on them and their life on hold, because for 6-7 years he was pursued by the tax office for doing the right thing.
And then in the end there was no penalty,
it
right?
He was given a non-conviction order.
Yeah, after all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He spoke at the Walkley Awards, was that last year or the year before? And that was incredibly, incredibly moving. Do you think Australia's whistleblower laws are mainly failing in design or in enforcement or in political will?
There's no doubt that the laws can be improved on paper, but a lot of it is how they are operating in practice, and a lot of that is enforcement and support. So a couple of years ago, we looked at every whistleblowing case to go to judgment in a court ever in Australia across 30 years under the federal laws. We've got 8 different federal whistleblowing laws. Only a single whistleblower had received compensation from a court. That whistleblower received $5,000. We've had these new private sector whistleblowing laws that on paper look really great. They are considered relatively strong. We've had them for 6 or 7 years. We haven't had a single whistleblower win in court because that power balance is so stacked. So that sort of institutional access to remedies.
So explain, they've gone to court and lost, yep. Or they've pulled out before they got to court?
Both.
Right.
But we've had a number of cases where they've gone to court and lost. That's why we're calling for a whistleblower protection authority, and that's why we're calling for access to support. The New South Wales Ombudsman scheme I mentioned is a really great example. They've set up a support team internally. So if you're a New South Wales public sector whistleblower, you want to blow the whistle, you can go to them, you can get support within the Ombudsman, you can get referred to us for legal help, you can get referred to a psychologist for wellbeing support. That's a great example of something that's so far working really well. We need to see that rolled out across the country.
Did you want to?
Yeah, I think in my experience is more on people doing things like you and me and the people here doing something like the whistleblower laws, you know, they will come and you know, we'll keep marching towards those, but it's the individual acts that I've seen that actually really can make a difference, and being able to go into an office of an MP and say, these people in your area, in your constituency, want you to do this and have that list of names. And then that turns into that MP taking an action, and that, you know, leads to someone like Julian Assange being brought home or individual donations, for instance, keeping Marcus safe. And these are all things that we can do ourselves without any legal change whatsoever. So anybody here who has contributed or done anything like that, congratulations, and please keep doing that. You know, it's one thing to vote, you know, every three years or so, but to continue that democratic engagement is so important, particularly for these cases that Kieran and I are working on. And it's just so useful and so powerful to have individuals taking action.
I'm getting quite a few practical questions here, which we were sort of going to at the end, but I think it seems to be what people really want to know about. If people are seeking whistleblowing advice, what's the best way people can get in touch to receive assistance? And I guess maybe a bit of a guide to if you work in a particular sector where you can go, when you go to the ombudsman, when you come to your organisation, like just a mud map of how people can get help.
Sure. If you go to our website, if you Google the Whistleblower Project, we have templates, we have flowcharts that explain all of the different whistleblowing laws. Right now, we've temporarily paused our intake of new clients because we're just rejigging our processes. We'll reopen shortly. You can contact us. If you work in the private sector, you can go to ASIC. If you work in the federal public sector, the Commonwealth Ombudsman in New South Wales, the New South Wales Ombudsman, that's where we need to improve this so that people can access the support and are not reliant on coming to one legal service that's funded by philanthropy and run.
And if someone was going to come to you, what should they expect? Like, how long does that process, you know, if I was going to come to you next week, how would that roll out? How long would it take? You know, what would the process look like?
So we triage everyone who comes to us. We assess their inquiry. We offer them resources. If we can't assist them, we'll try and send them somewhere, point them in the right direction, give them templates, give them flowcharts. If we can assist them, we'll give them an appointment. We'll give them some legal advice. If we can assist them on an ongoing basis, we'll take them on as a client. We might help them write to their employer, write to the ombudsman. We may assist them in ultimately blowing the whistle to a journalist, to a member of parliament. In some cases, taking to court.
Okay. I think you would all agree that this has been a pretty amazing discussion, extremely interesting, with lots of case studies and a lot of food for thought. I think it's really interesting to think about. I've never been in a position where I had to think about whistleblowing, and I guess for a lot of people, we don't really know what we would do if we saw something wrong or how we would go about calling it out. And what is very evident is that if you find yourself in that position, the support and the services are scant. They're here, but they're scant. And that's a really important thing for you, the person seeing the wrongdoing. But it's an important thing for all of us because the kinds of things that whistleblowers call to the attention of everybody else are the kinds of things that we all would want rectified, that we all would want called out. So I think it's an incredibly important conversation. It's incredibly important to hear what these organisations are doing. So I want to thank you all for coming out on a winter's night to talk about whistleblowing and to hear about this. I want to thank the anonymous whistleblower who gave us that incredibly powerful testimony. But most of all, I want to thank Gabrielle and Kieran for talking about the amazing work that they do. And could you please join me in thanking them?
Thank you.
And I wonder if today's conversation makes you feel more or less likely to blow the whistle on something wrong. Certainly some strong advocates in Kieran Pender, Associate Legal Director of the Human Rights Law Centre, founder of its Whistleblower Project Legal Service, and Gabrielle Shipton, filmmaker, storyteller, human rights advocate and founder of the Information Rights Project. And we'll link to their organisations in our show notes. You also heard from an anonymous whistleblower today, generously sharing their experiences working in juvenile jails. The host was Lenore Taylor, and big thanks to the Centre for Ideas at the University of New South Wales for that event. Check out their event schedule, lots coming up. My name is Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.